This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. Hello. My name is Brandon Arroyo, and welcome to the Porno Cultures Podcast. A lot of time is spent on this podcast defending the multitude of roles that pornography plays in people's lives. We say it's not a moral outrage. We say it's not an enemy of feminism. It's not corrupting young minds any more than any other media form. The academic study of pornography itself was established in a defensive mode against second-wave anti-porn feminism, against the lies perpetuated by the church, against the forces fighting sex worker rights. And because of this defensive posture, it's actually jarring whenever we see pornography portrayed in the mainstream media in a sensible, non-hysterical perspective. This is what makes the Netflix documentary Circus of Books such a revelation. Circus of Books tells the story of a gay pornography video and bookstore in West Hollywood that endured as a staple in this gayborhood through the AIDS crisis and the mainstreaming of gay culture that has willfully abandoned its porn past in favor of getting married and joining the military. In this documentary, pornography in the community built around this store is presented as a positive, unifying force where the gay community can indulge their sexual desires without shame. Here, pornography is glorified and needs no defending from anyone. It's the uplifting antidote to the sloppy mess that is the sordid, yet very enjoyable and enlightening tale of Tiger King and Joe Exotic. However, there is a unique wrinkle to this story that most people might have never expected. The Circus of Books store is owned by a highly religious, heterosexual Jewish couple, and they're not particularly even fans of pornography. They got into the pornography trade because Hustler was their highest-selling title when the family just happened to get into the magazine distribution business in between jobs. And while the family worked alongside many gay people throughout the business's 34-year history and served as an enduring symbol of gay sexual legitimacy during the AIDS crisis, the family faced a unique confrontation with the gay community once their own son, Josh, came out as gay. The coming out process for Josh wasn't as easy for him and the family as you might imagine. His mother Karen's devotion to her religion and Josh's shy nature made for a tough process that forces Karen to confront the conservative nature of her religion. The dual storylines of the family dealing with Josh's sexuality, alongside the store owner's battles with the Reagan administration, who tried to close them down in the 1980s while they were on their fanatical religious crusade against pornography, and the coming internet revolution that Circus of Books is unable to keep up with, provides a ton of drama throughout, which makes for a very dynamic and enjoyable story. It's not to be missed by anyone interested in pornographic history. In this episode, I'm joined by one of the film's producers, Adam Barron. Adam is an interesting character because most of his work deals with pornography and gay sexuality in a very straightforward and blunt fashion. Within an environment where being a buttoned-up, sexless chairman of a Fortune 500 company is considered to be a quote-unquote victory for the gay rights movement, Barron insistently positions gay pornography and sexuality as an essential part of what it means to be gay in the contemporary age. No matter how much mainstream culture encourages us to forget our sexuality in the service of serving the interests of capitalism and American imperialism, Barron's work reminds us of how crucial pornography was, and still is, in forming our political imagination and building broader gay communities. Barron has produced music videos, short films, web series, and documentaries that emphatically position pornography and sexuality at the center of the gay experience, which, within our sexphobic culture, is really quite an accomplishment. In this episode, we talk about how pornography helped him feel comfortable in his own skin, how writing about his own sex life online led to even bigger opportunities for him in his career, and how he's trying to restore the lost cruising history of the World Trade Center. So without further ado, here is my interview with the producer of Circus of Books, Adam Barron. I'm here with Adam Barron, former editor at Butt Magazine, the co-curator of the Queer Art Film Program at the IFC Center in New York City. The program was founded in 2009 and is still going strong, and they show a range of queer art films throughout time, which also feature talks by academics, filmmakers, activists that talk about the film at great length. Some of them are streaming online. I'll leave a link for those in the show notes. He's also the director of multiple short films and music videos. His porn-centric film, Jackpot, won the Best Short at the 2013 Miami Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. He's the co-writer of the web series The Hunting Season, which has plenty of softcore gay sex in it to keep viewers excited. He's the producer of the documentary Circus of Books, which is on Netflix, and it's about the famous gay porn shop in West Hollywood that's owned by a religious straight married couple, and all of the hilarity that ensues as a result of that. And yet, despite some of the hang-ups that the owners have about their work, the store itself represents a gay sexual history and practice that has endured through the AIDS crisis of the 1990s and the contemporary gay civil rights movements that we've had over the last 20 years. Though some of your sexual desires and experiences are already on the internet for many people to read and see, and we'll talk more about that, where did it all begin? We always start off the podcast by asking, what are our guests' first experiences with pornography? How old were you? And what were some of the lasting impressions that impacted the way you think about sex, even to this day?
I think my earliest memories are not really of pornography necessarily, but of glimpsing men in Speedos in the kind of 80s teen movies that would air on HBO in the middle of the day sometimes, or catching an episode of a daytime talk show. Like, I remember the Joan Rivers show, and every TV show used to have these like sweeps weeks where they would bring on male strippers. And I remember being completely transfixed by this male stripper kind of like pulling out his thong floss crack or whatever.
That was usually meant for the housewives, but I guess there were a lot of sick gay kids at home also watching.
Yeah, exactly. I think that those things were meant for housewives, and I was fortunate enough to sometimes be home or to be somewhere where I could see some of that stuff. And those are the earliest kind of things I remember. And then my first real encounter with a porn magazine was when I went to a convenience store to get my mom a can of soda, and I was going to get a comic book, and I went into this section where there was like comics and Mad magazines, and somebody had put a copy of the gay porn magazine Atom in that section, and I opened it and I started looking, and I wasn't even seeing like straight porn for my first porn, and I was just completely transfixed but also shamed by the store owner, who sort of saw and yelled at me. I said, you can't look at that stuff. And then I felt so guilty. I went out in the car and I just had this pit in my stomach that I was just doing bad, and this pit just grew and developed, and I just felt so guilty. I was like, guilt is making my body ache. And so I confessed to my mom, who was actually very kind and didn't punish me and told me just don't do that again, and thanks me for my honesty, and it was good. And then I realized that the pit in my stomach was actually just gas, and I didn't need to tell my mom anything at all. So that was kind of an imprint. But, you know, from there, the first straight porns I saw was Jennifer Flowers in Penthouse magazine. Then we watched a movie at my friend's house called When Harry Wet Sally. And I was just mostly interested in seeing the guys, but I was also horrified because I didn't want to be gay. And I thought that I had to both perform disinterest and horror, and some part of my brain was accessing it going, I like this. But it was deeply distressing to have these kind of interactions with porn until I basically admitted to myself that I was gay a few years later. And that was in the summer of my freshman year of high school. You know, at that point, I had traded straight porn magazines with friends or bought my own. And when I finally admitted to myself that I was gay, I was able to both buy Hustler magazine, which ended up having more shots of dicks in it than Penthouse and Playboy never had that stuff. I was able to buy that stuff and then was able to start accessing stuff on the internet when the internet came in.
You almost play off your mother's reaction as not being that big a deal. Like most mothers, they usually know without having to ask, but they just wait for you to admit it. Did you grow up in a more liberal household where being gay wasn't the worst thing in the world, and you were just dealing with your own demons, or was there family pressure?
Well, I think that my parents were very liberal, but I don't think my mother was like the mothers of today, who are like embracing their kids from a really early age and encouraging them to be who they want and letting them be gay at an earlier age. I definitely think that that was something then I put in a box because I also didn't want it to be. I mean, at that point, I basically just thought that I was a late bloomer and that just, you know, things would just come in their time. And, you know, all of a sudden I would just kind of blossom and I'd start liking girls and I'd find the right girl who was into me. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I felt really ugly most of my life and I hated how I looked. And so there was never any luck with me with girls. It was just always off the table. And there were always people who implied that I was gay or something like that. And I just always thought, well, maybe I'm just thinking that I'm gay because I fill out all these stereotypes and that I like the Bette Midler songs that my mom plays in the car and I like the more stereotypical things that they say gay people are into. And I don't know if it would have been okay if I had come out earlier, but I didn't, so it's hard to say. I think there was a certain point at which both my parents knew that I was trying to deal with it. I went to my dad at one point and said I had a dream that was gay, and he was like, well, dreams are just dreams, and you don't have to, you know, worry about it, and you're fine. And they both basically sort of said that they always suspected. But part of me kind of resents and wishes that during all that time suspecting that they had had the tools to say, how can we help him deal with this in a way that's more productive so that he's not eating himself up with guilt and anger and depression and all this kind of stuff that I still deal with, you know?
The teaching manual for parenting never ends, really. It's hard. You and I are pretty much the same age. You were born in 81. I was born in 82. And we grew up in the interregnum between a pre-internet world and a post-internet world. And for someone who remembers what it's like looking and thinking about pornography as a physical media form, in your mind, what are some of the things that you think we've kind of either lost and also gained from pornography's transition from a physical to a virtual medium? Because there's a lot of nostalgia in your work from Jackpot and The Hunting Season to Circus of Books, where the subjects are kind of longing for the good old days where pornography and hooking up was something that you could touch and that you did in person, and that they're regretting the change over. So it seems to be a theme in your work. You keep on going back to this nostalgia, yet it's also a balancing act because of the abundant amount of porn that we exist with today.
It's a complicated thing, and I think it's something that I'm always thinking about. I think you're quite right. I mean, we're what they call exennials or something. Like, we have basically the same amount of time from our birth to being 20. We had like 10 years of pre-internet and then the rest of the time with internet. So we like have this memory that porn was not just readily accessible to everybody in the world the way it is on phones and computers and every app everywhere. You couldn't just text your friend a picture of someone with a huge cock doing whatever fetish you were into. Then, you know, the ways you had access to porn were either that your parents had a secret stash of it that you found, which was something that when I started to hear about my friends who would say, oh, I found my dad's Playboy collection or something like that, I would just instantly get excited. And I remember the movie Weird Science, where they have this huge crate of pornography. And that was just so exciting to me to watch that and just to imagine, like, oh, my God, that's like my dream would be to have that like humongous stash of pornography, you know? And I think a lot of my life has been about fulfilling that dream because still I'm obsessed with collecting porn. And even on the internet, it's like there's bookmarking and creating collections on various sites. I think in terms of the themes that I keep going back to, you know, Jackpot was a movie that I made specifically about both dealing with bullies and also this idea that the quest for most 13-year-old gay boys was not meeting some other boy that I was going to hook up with, which would have been utterly unimaginable and terrifying to make a reality, but was just to have materials that I could look at and get off looking at them and feel the fullness of the type of orgasm that I thought I should be having. You know, in terms of going back to it, like, I do think, like, for instance, like right now I'm working on this series of shorts that is about forgotten cruising spaces, places that don't exist anymore, that very few people know still exist. And the first one I'm doing is about the World Trade Center and cruising spaces that existed at the World Trade Center before 9/11. And it really winds up in a place talking about how 9/11 changed everything. And a lot of it's because of surveillance culture and because the increased heightened suspicions of everything made any kind of place that was like underground, above ground, all of a sudden. So I think that that's kind of what the internet did. It's like the double-edged sword of information, you know. Suddenly I had access to hunkyhunks.com and all these other sites, and the sites would be organized. So if I wanted to see chubs, I could see chubs. If I wanted to see butts or anal or whatever, I could see it instantly. It's like I was just listening to the Hidden Brain podcast, and they talk about how the abundance of choice often makes us more stressed out and creates more problems, you know, and that people feel better about their decisions when they have less choices at the bay. And there's something about that to be said about like porn and the instant availability. That said, I wish I had been able to be like a lot of these younger people who by 18, they know they're like a hardcore piss pig, or they know that they're totally just into gainers and feeders. And, you know, I don't know. It's sometimes it's great. Like, it's hard to say one journey is better than another, but it's really what you do with it, you know?
It must be a devastating thing to learn at the age of 13 that you're a piss pig. But we all have our struggles in life.
I don't know that it's devastating. Maybe it's great, you know?
No, it is. You know, there's a sense of... one thing that annoys me a bit is that we always think that we can, you know, make decisions virtually. Like, sure, I may like watching something, but that doesn't mean if I actually do it in the physical world, it'll live up to my expectations or like it as much. I think there is something to both.
Absolutely.
Virtually exploring and physically exploring. Yeah. Like, you know, there has to be a balance of both. And I think, unfortunately, the internet and app culture somewhat forces us to make those decisions perhaps too early, you know.
I agree with you completely. I think that's the double-edged sword. And the double-edged sword is also that you learn things, just like a whole culture of gay men learned from the movies how they looked for cues, they looked for clues in the behavior of straight people for how to live their lives, and they didn't have access to gay people. And when you look at porn starting in the 70s and 80s, porn taught a whole generation of gay men new archetypes and ways for being and ways for fucking. And we continuously look to porn to learn how to have those sexual encounters, but it also creates these wrong expectations. And I think it often teaches people wrong behaviors that have to be unlearned. My friend Don Shuey writes about that a lot in his book, The Paradox of Porn.
And, you know, you talk about learning from straight culture. I mean, most of leather culture comes from gay men looking at straight men in leather, Marlon Brando, and adapting heterosexual macho types in order to make up for their seeming femininity, and then it becomes this whole separate gay culture. So yeah, the learning between straight and gay, virtual and analog, is always very interesting.
I just finished reading a book called The Silent Community by William Edward Delph. And it's a book written in the late 70s. And he goes around to all the cruising spots in Manhattan and tries to report, kind of like the book Tea Room Trade does, on the sociological behaviors of men in cruising situations. And what he essentially posits is that everything in these cruising spaces, in bathrooms, in theaters, in bars and stuff, is about silence. Because when you're silent, you can present that perfect image of the masculine man, of the man leaning against the wall with the perfect Levi's, with the perfect boots, and you can arch your hip the right way and put your hands in the right pocket. But when you start to talk, that's when you might get betrayed as more feminine, more Nelly, more this, more that. And so I think even beyond just the leather culture, there's something in gay sexual culture that for a long time devalued the feminine or the real in favor of these archetypes.
Yeah, absolutely. I find it fascinating that you're working on a short based on cruising spaces in the World Trade Center. Even just saying it almost sounds sacrilegious, considering the patriotic site that Ground Zero has become. I remember right after 9/11 happened, people complaining vehemently about the proposal of a mosque being built at the site of Ground Zero, which was an early plan to have a mosque built there to show that Islam was not the thing that caused 9/11. And I remember family members being outraged that there would be a mosque being there. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, there's tons of strip clubs that were there before and that are there still now, yet no one is upset about the strip clubs. So it's interesting that the sexual politics around Ground Zero. Have you come up against any people that seem offended by the idea of resituating the World Trade Center as a sexual space, considering that now it's a type of holy memorial for America?
Well, I think that's what the film really shows. I haven't put it out there yet, and so we're still editing it, so it's a little premature to talk about it. But basically, you know, we are talking about the film at 9/11 in a broader context, and we're trying to show how there were all these spaces in the World Trade Center and all over the city. You could go into random buildings everywhere, and Bloomingdale's, an office building, a park. You could just go to these places and suss out usually where there was cruising. And once 9/11 happened, everything just kind of shut up. And that becomes a metaphor for what happens around the world in terms of freedoms being restricted, in terms of surveillance getting heightened, in terms of us being more on guard and less willing to allow ourselves the freedom to exist in spaces that are not fully observed by the main apparatus of the state and the government. So I don't know. I'm sure there will be people who are going to criticize it and will be offended. But what I hope that people get more from the film is this feeling of what has been lost. And of course, we're not minimizing in any way the lives lost by the tragedy of 9/11. What I'm actually trying to do is to say, look, when you go to the 9/11 Museum, when you go to World Trade Center, there's all this history that's been erased in favor of the established governmental, societal, acceptable line of these were the lives that were lost in 9/11. And these are the ones that matter. You go into the 9/11 Museum, there's a whole section about the dogs that were used to sniff out things. But there isn't anything about gay people. And so I think what this film is actually doing is trying to say, look, there were gay people all over the place doing things and finding each other and creating connections in ways that straight society had no idea about.
Absolutely.
And there very well could have been gay men in the towers that were there for cruising and that we don't even know their names or their lives because they were acting in a completely underground way. And let's just acknowledge that history too. And let's just acknowledge that most of these established histories that are created in museums and by governments and by societies often leave out gay people and gay sexuality. And that's really what my work is all about, is trying to say, hey, I think you forgot about something, you know? I think you forgot that gay people have always existed and that we've always been sexual. We've always found ways to be sexual. And those histories need to be understood and acknowledged.
The strange thing to me about fetishizing death the way that the 9/11 memorial does is that life is a part of death, right? You can't appreciate the weight of death unless you appreciate the glory of life, and sex is life. Sex brings people together. Sex enlivens relationships. So they must go hand in hand. If you're going to appreciate the tragedy of it, you have to appreciate the life that sex brought to the place initially. So it'll be very interesting to see how it's accepted. It's an interesting project to be pursuing for sure.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm starting now to collect stories for the second and the third and the fourth. I'm going to make a series of these shorts. And I'm not just looking at New York, I'm looking around the world.
So you directed a music video for the song Dirty Boots by the band Hollow Paw. It's an homage to leather culture and the free love 70s gay sex. It stars kind of the premium Tumblr indie gay erotic icon at the time, Dominic J. Fulnier, who's from Montreal. He was getting big while I was living in Montreal, so I always have a special place in my heart for him. He was very iconic. And the video is also narrated by leather gay porn icon Peter Berlin, who's famous for his two films from the mid-70s, That Boy and Nights in Black Leather. Each film centers on leather culture and gay cruising scene in San Francisco in the 70s. How did you get connected with Hollow Paw, and what was your motivation for creating an homage to gay leather culture for this music video?
John Orth, who was the lead singer of Hollow Paw, was a friend of mine. And, you know, I was in a point where I was just looking to create work. I think every time I decide to create a film, it's after a long period of fucking around and then suddenly being like, wait, I have no new work to show anyone. And that song came into play. And I really liked that song. And I just went over to his concert one night in the blizzard. I asked him if he'd be up for me doing a video, and he said yes. And it's weird because I definitely did sort of think of it as an homage to 70s porn, but I didn't necessarily think of it as an homage to leather culture. More so, I was looking at it as an homage to Kenneth Anger and Scorpio Rising, which, of course, is the proto-leather culture movie. So I had interviewed Peter Berlin for The Sword, which I was writing for, which was Naked Sword's blog. I had a column there called Fisting for Compliments. And, you know, I just asked him to do it while we were doing the interview. And he was really great to deal with. And I just saw him again when he came to New York for the release of the photosexual book that my friend Michael Bullock just put together, which is an incredible collection of his artwork and photography. And he's a sweetheart. I guess in that video, I was really trying to show a community of sluts that were united and committed to a world and a life of hedonism, who lived in an underground club, basically, who kind of went from waking up groggy, posing, trying out their bizarre new homemade fetish gear to going right back to the sex club where they spent every night doing debauched things. And then since I made that video, I basically, that's become my life too.
Lucky you.
In some ways. So, yeah.
That's fantastic. Do you remember the first time you saw a Peter Berlin film?
Well, I think I watched both of those Peter Berlin films on home video at some point. You know, they're not my favorite of the porn films that exist in the 70s. I do like them a lot. And there's parts in that video where I actually play the Peter Berlin films on the guys in the video. I project film prints onto the guys. But they're just the prototypical, what do you think about porn? You know, they're these kind of, he's walking around town, he's having encounters, he's going here, he's going there, you know, and he's parading himself in this incredible way. But I tend to prefer the films of Jack DeVoe and Jerry Douglas and Joe Gage and Fred Halstead if I'm watching 70s porn. Sorry, Peter, but I kind of think that Fred's films are more my favorite. I really love L.A. Plays Itself. And in many ways, I got inspiration from Sex Tool and L.A. Plays Itself for the Trade Center short that I'm doing. So there's touches of that in that.
Yeah, I think the appeal of the Berlin films is that they're very idiosyncratic. Yeah, that's very much a part of the film. They're very much his desires and his kind of point of view. So you either are in it or you're not. They're definitely not made for a mainstream audience, I think, for the most part. They're very particular.
Right.
Which is part of the charm, but also part of why they don't have the same mainstream appeal.
I think there's two strains of porn that I really like. And the one is things that are really try to intermingle realism and fantasy films where people are walking around the city and just encountering things. But then you also get a glimpse of city life, like LA Plays Itself and Night at the Adonis, NYC Inferno, where people are just showing you a scene. And then there's this other strain that's really like entering the fantasy world, which is films like James Bidgood's Pink Narcissus, or my absolute favorite, which is Wakefield Pool's Bijou, where the guy enters a club and enters this surreal Powell and Pressburger fantasy world.
That's one way of putting it, yes.
You know, they're just these really cinematic, technicolor, hypersexual worlds. I like both of those. I like the real and I like the fantasy.
Yeah. And Jackpot, a film we've talked about, is your short from 2013 where a teenage character finds out from his friend that there's a stash of gay porn magazines in the neighborhood dumpster. The kid is very excited and he goes to fetch them. While he's preparing to bring the magazines back to his house, he's confronted by bullies who threaten to beat him up. The kid finds kind of inspiration to stand up for himself from one of the magazine cover boys who comes to life in the boy's imagination. It's kind of like a Jojo Rabbit where there's an imaginary friend speaking into your ear and inspiring you to do things. This cover is not as nefarious as Hitler, I can assure you, but he does offer the kid the moral support he needs at the time, and the kid eventually does get beat up, but he returns home with the magazine featuring the cover boy and smiles, knowing that he has the confidence to stand up for his gay desires. How did the idea for this film come to you, and maybe you can tell us a little about the process of financing it and filming it?
Sure. Well, that film came to me because I was thinking about the idea of an odyssey film, a quest. And I immediately thought, well, one thing I wanted when I was a kid was a stash of gay porn. And I had this dream that I was a kid and I was out looking for a stash of gay porn and I found the porn and I was desperate to get it home. And I thought, well, there's my film, you know, that's a quest film. And it's a nice way to spin that teenage quest movie, you know, the kid trying to get something or get somewhere in his town to do something. And what he really wants wants is this thing that he shouldn't have under any circumstances, that no adult would recommend a kid have. I based a lot of it on my own experiences being bullied, and I also based it on my own reluctance to ever get into a full formal fight with any of my bullies. I always ran away. And I think something in the film was that I had this realization later, was that I wished that I had just stood up to them, because at least I would not have that feeling of always running away. And so I thought of the porn magazine coming to life as this magical realist element that could help him realize all these images of masculinity and costumes that the guy takes on. Eventually, the kid winds up wearing them all at the end to fight the bullies. So he's taking these cues of standing up for himself that are coming from this person who's a porn star, who's just fully unafraid and unashamed of everything that he's doing, willing to be completely naked on a magazine cover. And that there's some equation of that between standing up for yourself and having the willingness to be who you are in public. And in terms of financing it, we financed it through the early days of Kickstarter. And I had all these amazing artists who have porn fixations create original artworks. And we sold prints and posters. And I made tote bags that said honcho and inches and black inches. And we just basically turned it into this hub for cool, weird porno art. And that was how we financed it. And we shot it and put it out. And it's been a big success. And like, weirdly, it just kind of keeps going because, like, I don't know, 3 months ago, all of a sudden, and everybody just started following the Facebook page for Jackpot again. And I was like, oh, okay. I don't know. I guess either it got featured somewhere or some person who has a following put it into their Vimeo queue or something, because suddenly like everybody started following my page again. And I was just like, okay. I mean, I still have the script for the feature version sitting here waiting for it to be made. That never ended up happening. That was a big struggle to get that made. And it kind of fell apart like a lot of my projects.
Well, in the age of Love, Simon, you'd have to change it to like a Sears catalog. It wouldn't be able to be pornography.
Right. Yeah, and that was the thing I was railing against. I was just firmly committed to the idea that it has to be pornography.
Yeah. Older actors are used to playing gay because it catapults their career as a serious actor. But when you're a 14-year-old actor, it's not as easy. Did you have trouble finding an actor that was willing to play gay like this?
No, I didn't have trouble. It was actually pretty easy. And the harder part was I found myself in this position with my actor, Ethan Navarro, who's great, who I think has since come out and all that. But at the time, I didn't want to be the adult who came in and tried to push him to say to me, you know, yes, I'm actually gay. So there was an aspect of directing where I was trying to skirt that issue because I knew from my own experience how upsetting it is when you are maybe visibly or outwardly gay, but you don't want people to come to you and acknowledge that fact. So I remember I had an experience where I was 18 and this older person was like, so you're gay, right? And I was just like, no. And I didn't really want to do that with Ethan either. So I had to find a way to direct him that didn't address those subjects. And he was just a natural and he did such a great job.
That's fantastic. I think a lot of people don't realize that a lot of a director's job is knowing when not to say something. It's harder to not say something, but it seemed to turn out great. It's a really nice performance and a nice film. And that's the thing with short films. They have their life of their own online and you never know when they're going to get a ton of hits 1 month and not. So it's interesting to see that journey. You worked as an editor for Butt magazine. It's pretty famous, but maybe you can tell us a little bit of the history of Butt, how you got involved with them, and I guess what it was like putting some of your own sex life in print. You have a very explicit article, New York Sex Slut Has Super Wet Sex with Older Guy, where you explain in detail your sexual encounter. So kind of interesting merging your personal life and your work life and your sex life all into one.
I think that I had always been into reading stories of true sexuality. And all of a sudden, I'm like 20 and I'm out and I'm looking around like I think everyone was. And all the gay media is just basically this one cookie cutter style, which is basically like sub porn. Like we're trying to have all the aesthetics of pornography, the semi-naked guys, you know, ooh, what such and such actor is shirtless on the cover? Let me buy that issue of Out Magazine without the porn. porn without the sex. And I think, of course, there's a lot of reasons for that, and a lot of reasons connected to gay assimilation drives and not wanting to make everything about sex because that was the stereotype. But I really enjoyed all of a sudden stumbling on the second or third issue of Butt Magazine, which was a publication started in Amsterdam by two friends who were also bored with gay publications and the cliche and tacky way that they had been proliferated. And some of that style I like now and want to go back to. And but the, you know, Butt Magazine was done in a very different way. It was printed on this pink paper that was subtly suggestive, and the font was like a zine. And in the magazine, there would be, what was a revelation for me was reading stories where famous people and non-famous people would talk openly about their sex lives. That was just like a total revelation for me. And then it kind of became the thing where if you wanted to be featured in Butt Magazine, you would send them a story, and if they liked it, they'd print it. And so I sent them my first story, which was about my first short film and how the magazine helped me get laid, because somebody from that film came over and saw the magazine and we ended up hooking up. And then from there, I just started writing more and interviewing more. And I really love just talking with people about sex. I think I'm a good interviewer, and I think I'm good at just writing about my own sexual experiences. And it was freeing. I think only recently in life have I realized that I have this big exhibitionist streak that I may be in heavy conflict with, but I'm trying to access it more. But, you know, that was really freeing for me, freeing for my sexuality. It certainly helped me get laid more. Which was part of the goal. And, you know, I just so enjoyed doing that magazine and contributing and making something that became an alternative for a whole generation of people and has really informed gay media going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite a revolutionary moment when Butt was at its peak, for sure. And then you kind of continued that. We had Zachary Shire on the show, who got his start working at The Sword. I wasn't aware that you worked at The Sword. He was the main blogger there for a while. The Sword is connected to Naked Sword, which is a porn production distribution house. And back in around 2008, 2009 was the primary gay porn blog that reported on news and scandal and gossip. You worked there as well. How did you get connected with The Sword, and what kind of work were you doing there for them?
I think they reached out to me, and I decided to pitch them a column called Fisting for Compliments, which was basically that I wanted to do what I did at Butt Magazine, but more with a porn focus. And I like doing interviews, but Butt Magazine only came out like six times a year, maybe. And I wanted to just talk to people more and also write more journalistic style pieces. So I interviewed all sorts of porn stars, Peter Berlin and Joe Gage and directors and projectionists. And I just really tried to find, like I'm doing now, stories of forgotten cruising experiences, forgotten porn experiences, and also just talk and try and get in the heads of some of these porn stars who were doing it at the time and learn what made them tick, what it was like to be on a set, what was like editing these scenes, what are the intricacies. And basically, I'm not unique in that regard. I'm just following in the footsteps of Jerry Douglas, who did that so brilliantly for Manshots magazine. And I just really liked long interviews, like long, almost unedited interviews where you could really dig into all the ums and ahs and weird vagaries of conversation that people get into when they're talking about real stuff.
Yeah, so you're doing all of this like around 2010, and this is at a time where the mainstreaming of gayness is on hyperdrive, where gayness, gay marriage, gays in the military, all of this stuff is happening, and you, in some people's perspective, the opposite way, going towards the more marginal, less mainstream, more overtly sexual, less monogamous type stuff. Did you feel like you were swimming against the stream, or did you just cultivate a group of friends that were like-minded? Did you experience any hostility or questions from other gay friends who were wondering why you're doing this when you should be, you know, marching with Lady Gaga chanting Born This Way?
No, I don't think so. I think everybody who knows me pretty much knows that that's not my style, and that I'm just always interested in finding the stuff that not everybody is into. I mean, I know that's a cliche because that's a whole other type of gay and hipster mode of behaving. But,
and everyone is into porn, they just don't admit it.
Right, exactly. And I think that it didn't really have anything to do with the outsiderness of wanting to do those things. It was more just that I was interested and thought those things were cool and just thought that, okay, well, nobody's doing this stuff, so I'll do this stuff. We're in this mode now of extreme censorship where sites that are gay that use explicit language would probably today have to tell their writers to use lots of euphemisms because they wouldn't be search engine optimized in the Google system. I was working for a company and we got a directive like that, basically, that was like, nobody's finding us because all these very simple terms, sex, anal, butt, really basic stuff, is causing the Google monitors to tag them as adult. And that causes them not to be searchable. And that doesn't help. So a lot of these sites and things probably are struggling more to do that. So porn is always under fire, no matter how much everybody thinks it's cool and accepted, it's not. So in some ways, it was like I was responding against a specific moment as much as that I'm just always kind of like this.
Yeah. To be gay today almost seems like you live in two different worlds where you have the straight media and the straight world glorifying you for monogamy, gay adoption, born this way, joining the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, and a gay community, which most of them, I can't speak for all, but if you cultivate the right people, are very suspect of these things. So you have to play both sides, like to your grandmother who's happy for gay marriage and your best friend, you and him talk and you realize that that's, you know, such bullshit. Many ways. So it's almost as if you have to live two minds simultaneously to be a contemporary gay person these days.
I think the thing that illustrates what you're talking about the most is when Pete Buttigieg...
Ugh.
we don't have to say ugh right away, but I wasn't a fan of Pete Buttigieg, but I was able to understand why he was a symbol for a lot of men. And a lot of it, of course, has to do with the trends towards assimilation and what he represented, more so than that he had any interesting policy positions. It was mainly just about he was this figure who seemed acceptable to everyone. And wasn't it amazing that he was acceptable to everyone? And that was what they fed off of. But one of the things that I thought was the most telling was when he made that comment that got a lot of controversy, that was negging on the ideas of radicalism, that we don't need someone like Bernie or whatever who's going to be radical or stir up the pot. And everyone kind of came for him and said, well, what about Stonewall? And what I thought really missed the point was that so many of the gay activists who shaped our world and created our freedoms, it wasn't just about Stonewall. Like, long before Stonewall, the gay activists were all radicals. They were communists. They were people with deep socialist sympathies. They really were people who identified the societies were not providing what they needed to, and that we needed to be in solidarity with everybody. And, you know, Harry Hay, who founded the Mattachine Society, basically one of the architects of modern gay rights movement, was drummed out of the Mattachine Society because he was a communist. And people just forget these things, that their gay forefathers were all real radicals in a sense. And people also forget that when they want to neg...
Not to mention the whitewashing as well.
Sure. But what I think in terms of, if we want to relate this to porn, anything back in the day that was about gay people in any explicit way was considered pornography. And people need to understand the definition of pornography is not a fixed definition. It changes with every single society that it's in. So back in the 60s and the 50s, any mention of gayness was considered pornography. Secondly, that when the actual gay porn magazine movement starts, which relates in many ways to Circus of Books, those magazines were magazines that were the only places that gay men could get actual news about their lives, political news. You know, you pick up a magazine like Drummer, any issue you pick up is going to have a rant about Reagan, about conservative politics. These were places where politics went hand in hand with porn. And they went that way because the people who were putting these magazines out knew firsthand how unjust the governmental persecution of gay people were and how they were using porn to pursue attacks on gay culture as a whole, because they didn't want gay people to have access to materials that showed them themselves, that showed them how to have sex, because that was what they were desperately afraid of. People forget that the word pornography initially derives from a Greek word meaning writing about prostitutes. So the whole history of porn is tied up with sex workers and sex worker rights. And, you know, now we see gay men making rude remarks on Facebook about people doing OnlyFans in the coronavirus crisis. And it's like, hello, do you understand that every bit of struggle that you have overcome or every freedom that you have access to is probably in some way due to somebody who put out something that was considered porn at one point or another?
Absolutely. Yeah. If only Pete could realize that, then we'd have a different conversations about it.
I think Pete knows those things. I think Pete just was pretending to be what he thought he needed to be in order to get himself closer to the presidency.
Well, I mean, Pete's father is one of the premier Marxist scholars. So he certainly knows everything about Marxism.
Exactly. Yet
none of it seemed to have stuck, or at least in his public persona. So there's a lot to be suspicious there.
Well, look, if your father was all about something, you go against it, okay? I mean, that's the way it is.
Yeah, look at him and Kamala Harris, yeah. So, unfortunately, being a rebel used to mean that you were more avant-garde, not more conservative, so I don't know. And of course, you are one of the co-writers on The Hunting Season, and this was a web series, kind of like a more overtly gay Sex and the City. Even though Sex and the City is gay, it's just women speaking like gay men. This is gay men speaking like gay men. Living in New York, doing the sex thing. And for a web series, I mean, it really is quite sexual. I mean, there's an unrated version that shows penises, shows some deeper kind of softcore gay sex that we probably hadn't seen since Queer as Folk, really. So I guess when you're putting something like this together, what were the negotiations about showing sex, having sex so prominently featured? What were some of your parameters for how you wanted to show the sex on that series?
Well, I wasn't the director, so some of those questions I don't totally have access to. But I'll say that The Hunting Season was based on a blog called The Great Cock Hunt, which was the purported true stories of a slut who seemed to just fall into wild sexual experiences wherever he went. And it was a very popular blog, and then he wrote a book version, and my friend John Marcus acquired the book and the column and set about turning it into a series. And I think that I was the ideal writer for this because at the time I was the sort of blogger who was telling my own sex stories and being open about everything in my life to a fault. And I wanted to explore both how a sexual gay person interacts with straight culture at large, but also how when you are a person who's putting yourself out there and being very open about your sex life and blogging about it and being public about it, that maybe it often leads you into places where you do things that you wouldn't normally do. And so I think some of that gets explored more in the second season, which I didn't write. But in terms of the first season, I wanted it to be as natural in terms of the conversations that people had as possible. And I was definitely interested in creating something that at its core was sex positive and that allowed people to have broader minds in some way.
Yeah. And it really works out well. It's more sexually progressive than a lot of series. I mean, you have the stereotype of the guy who's been in a relationship for 6 years, the guy who doesn't believe in any romance, the main character who's kind of somewhere in between where he kind of wants a relationship, but he kind of wants to have his cake and eat it too. And so it really covers a dynamic range, and to show the sexuality and the nudity like you do in a way really brings a sense of reality to it that even a show like Sex and the City didn't really do. And I was always a little bit freaked out in the steam room scene in the first season. A very good-looking Hispanic man walks in and you see his penis. I'm like, wait a minute, I actually worked with that guy. I was a waiter with him right near Ground Zero, actually, for a few years. Kirk, he's a good gay communist, so I love following him. So it was even more real for me. And of course, filming in the Phoenix like you do, it was like a perfect show for me growing up in New York.
Great. I'm really glad to hear that. You know, only like a year after that show came, there was Looking, there was, you know, a lot of shows. And I mean, of course, there had been Queer as Folk before that, but I feel like we did in many ways because it really was a popular show. I mean, it was watched very, very widely around the world. And I hear a rumor that they're still trying to do more with it, which would be great. And now you have things like Himeros, Davey Wavy's thing. You know, they have series on there with porn stars and the porn stars are doing a great job acting and having sex. Something like that, that's a fusion of those things where we don't have to be without, is something that's super important to me.
Yeah. So we'll end off with Circus of Books, the documentary you could watch right now on Netflix.
Yes.
I just want to start with a little bit of a basis for Rachel. Rachel Mason, who's the director and the daughter of the couple who run the porn shop in West Hollywood, Circus of Books. That is the center of the documentary. And the documentary profiles former employees and other gay people around that time. And they talk about how important the gay bookstore was, not only as a site for erotic excitement, but also for its political presence in the community, especially during the AIDS crisis. And during the documentary, Rachel's brother is revealed to be gay, and they talk about his struggles of being gay. A very interesting documentary. But I didn't know, and I still don't know much about Rachel herself, because she references that she's an artist, and I looked at a little bit of her work as an artist. So I guess, how did you meet her? Describe what her artwork is like for those who don't know it. And then I guess describe how you started negotiating with her about working on this documentary with her.
Sure. So I had known Rachel through my friend Billy Miller, who publishes the magazine Straight to Hell, which is a really pioneering gay underground zine that collects true sex stories from gay men and has for years, and used to be run by a really great guy named Boyd McDonald, who's no longer alive. So Billy used to invite me to see Rachel's performances, and Rachel used to do all sorts of really wild stuff. She'd do these performances where she would stand on a chair and she'd have this long flowing dress, so she looked like she was 20 feet tall, and she'd be singing on a guitar and singing these strange and ethereal songs. And she was just always really interesting to me, and she had an interesting story. And eventually, through Billy, he had a panel at one point about Bob Meiser, the pioneering AMG models, physique pictorial photographer, and he invited Rachel's parents to be on the panel. And that was the first time I think I realized they ran Circus of Books, which I had been to when I was in LA. And at some point, after knowing Rachel for a number of years and Billy and everything, Rachel came to me and told me she was thinking about making this movie, you know, about her parents and what should she do. And I was like, just go start filming, because they may close the store down at any moment. We filmed for 3 or 4 years, and at any moment they could close the store down tomorrow, because that's how they were. So we knew we had to capture it. In terms of more about what Rachel's work is about, she's made experimental films. She made a really great experimental film called The Lives of Hamilton Fish that I encourage people to seek out. It's very, very different from Circus of Books. And seen her do all sorts of stuff over the years. She impersonates Donald Trump. She dresses as a clown. She makes all sorts of really out there, really interesting experimental work. In terms of how she got me involved, beyond me telling her to just start filming, you know, I was able to help raise a good chunk of change to help start the financial process of the movie so that filming could be started, and basically supported with a lot of creative decisions and creative feedback over the years as we worked on the movie and got closer and closer to being finished right up until the edit.
So I think this is a basic question. I study film, and sometimes I don't even know the answer to this question. I guess we have this romantic vision of a documentarian going on their own for years to capture all this footage and then hide away for years in an editing room to assemble all the footage together. But, you know, most people in that narrative don't understand what role a producer on a documentary plays in putting it together. So just on a general level, at least in your experience, what does a producer on a documentary do when there's so many singular moments between the documentarian filming a subject and the subject responding to the camera? What does a producer on a documentary do? Or at least, I guess you can't answer it for everyone, but at least in your case.
What's misleading about the question is that I think there are different kind of producers. Every documentary has a lot of different producers, and every producer may do something different, and some of the producers may overlap depending on how much input they have in the movie, depending on how much money they're putting into the movie. There might be a producer, let's say, who comes along with the money, finds the filmmaker and says, this is the film I want you to make. And so that producer is more explicitly guiding the film and has a very definitive creative control over the finished product. And I think there are producers who are there more to support the filmmaker's vision because they believe in the filmmaker's vision. They think the film could be a success, and they want to just help the director, who is the artist, make the work that they want to make. So it's all different. Hopefully that's what every producer is doing, is helping the director make the film they want to make, and in whatever capacity they can. You know, there can be everything from being on set, being there day to day, booking the crew, managing the finances, managing the workload. And by workload, I mean the day's footage gets logged and put into a drive and gets duplicated so that you have backup copies. There's all these intricate things that various producers could do. And on that film, I think we all did a lot of different things. Me, as a producer, often I'm raising money and giving feedback and giving notes and trying to help shape projects into the best thing that they can be, that tells the stories that are the most important.
And you would say that it took 3 to 4 years from beginning to end?
I think it took about 5 years.
Wow.
5 years from beginning to end.
Yeah. To just encounter Karen Mason, the mother, in the documentary is jarring. Do you have recollections of the first time you actually met her, and what were your impressions of her?
Well, sure. I actually interviewed Karen for The Sword at some point early on. I think it was before the film was well underway. So when I did that interview, that kind of really helped me lay out what the story was, all the different beats. I knew then about her son. I knew then about the FBI raids, you know, and it was sort of just clear, like, oh, yeah, there's a documentary here. What I remember about Karen personally was that what you see in the film is that she's tough. She is nice. She is happy to talk to any journalist. She's really open. But there is this strange dichotomy where you're constantly wondering, well, wait, how do you really own a porn star and you really don't look at this material? And I think that central hook is what has captivated so many viewers over the past few weeks, just trying to recognizing that sort of strange dichotomy of this woman who could be your mom running this business. And like I said, when I was a kid, if you'd suddenly told me at 13 that my parents were running a gay porn store, man, that would have been the greatest thing in my entire life. But what's so interesting to me is that in Josh's case, the son in that movie, it was actually this terrible thing for him because the chance of encountering gay material when you're trying not to be gay and trying not to see it and trying not to show that you're interested in it is probably terrifying, you know?
The main conflict with Josh, you know, and Josh is the brother who comes out as gay and has trouble confronting his mother with that topic, is that it speaks, I guess, to what you talked about earlier with every gay person having their own timetable. And if anyone is going to jump the timetable until you're ready to say it, then that causes a crisis of identity. And I think that's one of the main things that's explored.
Yeah, until you're ready to admit to yourself that you're gay and are willing to face the idea of what my existence look like as an out gay person, you do not want to be confronted with images of men in Speedos or men with erections or men pissing on each other, whatever it is that you may chance to come in contact with. And I think for Josh, you see in the film how his struggle to be the model son and be the perfect member of his perfect all-American family is what brings him into the most conflict with his family.
Yeah.
And himself.
We were talking about Bernie before. Bernie's platform is about class politics. And if I do have one critique of the film, it would be somewhat of the timetable and also the class issue. Because if we look at Rachel, she graduated from Yale and her brother was going to Columbia at the time in New York when he was struggling with coming out. They're business owners. They obviously have enough money to send their kids to these schools. Living in New York and living in LA, it's not as if these are two very homophobic places to live. There is a kind of a lack of acknowledgement of the class privilege here in this family of going to these highly elite schools, living in highly enlightened areas. So I'm just wondering the conflict between living in a very cosmopolitan way, yet also struggling with coming out of the closet because of a retrograde religious mentality that blocks Karen from accepting her son immediately. It ignores Josh's financial privilege of being in Columbia in the first place, living in New York City, being able to go out to gay bars 3,000 miles away from his family if he wants to. You know what I'm saying?
Of course, it's easier for a person of even a middle-class privileged background to have this experience with coming out, and he could go back to Columbia and all these things. But I don't think that his fear of being completely disowned or disinherited was a misguided one, because I think that happens to people of a high class as well as people who aren't from a privileged class.
Yeah, I do. I think it's probably perhaps a better question for Josh or Rachel, because they're living in the moment. But I was just interested in that, especially when I found out that Rachel went to Yale. And so there was a certain class that you're entered into when you enter these institutions, and a cosmopolitan expectation. And yes, that doesn't detach you from your mother or your father and the roots of all that. But I just find it interesting that, yeah, I guess it could have been explored a bit more. But the crux of it is really the relationship between the mother and the son.
Sure. Look, I think that in terms of class, look, they were making a lot of money from pornography. And if Rachel went to Yale or Josh went to Columbia or something, I think part of that is because that's what the porn business paid for.
Yeah, which is interesting.
So it is this circular thing of like, the problem is about that there's class privilege. The porn was what actually kind of vaulted them, let's say, into a more stable middle class place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the aspects I love the most about the documentary is the contrast of the characters that are invested in and benefited from this. I mean, you have Larry Flint with a father. He gets involved in distributing Hustler, and that's how he starts his porn empire. And then Alaska Thunderfuck, a much younger drag queen from RuPaul's Drag Race, talking about his experience working in the store. So it's interesting, the intergenerational narrative that is centered around pornography at the time in collecting characters, you know, older characters that have been there for 25 years versus young people that are just discovering their sexuality. Was there interesting framing in which they talk about porn in a different way? You know, one generation stressing its importance, another generation thinking of it as an accessory? Or was there kind of more universal narratives built around using porn as a community builder?
Well, I think you see a lot of different types of people in the film. I mean, some of the interview subjects are young and they recall their first pornography experience, and it's still connected to Circus of Books. I mean, certainly I loved going to Circus of Books because it was a porn store that embraced gay porn. And in terms of collecting the subjects, we interviewed a lot of people, and there's people who didn't make it into the film, and there's scenes that didn't make it into the film of events like my friend Bradford Nordine, who does the Dirty Look series, which is a queer experimental film screening series that was based in New York and now is based in LA, who did an event at the Circus of Books that was really honoring its history, where initially we showed the extended clip of Circus of Books at that event. And that event was populated both by young people and old people, all of whom spoke to Karen and Barry about how incredible the store was for them and for their development. And even Jeff Stryker came, and the mayor of West Hollywood came and declared it Circus of Books Day in West Hollywood. So I didn't see necessarily people viewing it differently. I think that the divide was because of something like Butt Magazine, which came out and really took that old porn aesthetic and bridged it for a new generation and set forth this whole zine explosion. I think you have a new generation now who have this fixation, fascination, appreciation, love of older forms of porn, historically interested in porn more from the past than they are from the present. And I think you have a lot of the older people now are less interested in the old porn, and they want to look at all the new stuff. They're the ones who are subscribing to the OnlyFans. They're the ones who are looking at all the Tumblrs and on all the apps, and they're everywhere. So it's all a continuum. It's all a circle, and everything comes back up and up and up and up over and over again. And the more we make connections and the more we shine a light on the forgotten histories of our sexuality and our sexual development as gay and queer people, the more we're going to realize that we should all be united and we should all be struggling together and struggling for everyone else in the world, you know?
I think one of the things that you don't often think about, but this documentary really brings it up in a good way, is how much effort and emphasis and time and money went into the Meese Commission, which of course is the second commission after the first commission under Nixon, said that porn had no ill effects in the world. This was a conservative religious right commission purposefully for the purpose of saying that porn was a public evil. And how much effort went into that, and even busting Karen and Barry, and yet how little effort went into dealing with the AIDS crisis. Initially, you just think to yourself, you know, we have a president right now that's not dealing with a pandemic crisis, and it just repeats itself. But it's just remarkable the contrast in how much the government went into busting this mom and pop store instead of dealing with the actual crisis of AIDS at the time.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I'm really happy that the film shows that. I think it's interesting because you think like, oh, everyone knows about these things, but a whole generation of people on Twitter are posting about, OMG, I didn't realize all this stuff. And maybe some people would be like, oh, well, can't believe they didn't know that stuff. But better they get it from somewhere than they don't get it at all. And so I think anything that emphasizes those points is good. It's a complex question, but you know, yeah, our government is focused on all the wrong things right now. I mean, there's a great book called The Secret Museum by Walter Kendrick. It's a great book because it's really all about how porn has always been used as a scapegoat, as a thing to demonize, as a thing to help control. And what I mean by this is that the government has always used it this way. The government and any state apparatus has always viewed things that were explicit, erotic, pornographic as things that they needed to control and needed to use as scare tactics. Yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, the politicians conveniently, because they know better, but conveniently they situate it as this moral hazard. Yet I found it interesting, and I never really heard a porn star thought of this way, but Rich Jews React's column about the movie really called Circus of Books and porn shops back then a safe space, which I never thought of a porn star being a safe space. But when you see it in the context of this documentary, and also the people having sex in the back parking lot, which is a part of the documentary, and it really does emphasize the idea that this was a safe space for gay men to meet, to talk, to be together, to create a community. Yet that morality is never discussed when you talk about pornography.
Right. And some of the things that aren't in the film, for instance, like Circus of Books was not the only gay porn store in L.A., but there was a huge history of L.A. really persecuted and went after the adult businesses everywhere. So if you go to the One Archives, which are featured in the film, there's tons and tons of records of persecution just by the local authorities in L.A. And Circus of Books, yes, had Vaseline Alley, which everybody knew about and was basically accepted. And Circus of Books was a 24-hour business. So you could go there at any point in the day. And actually, at some point in the 80s, West Hollywood basically made them stop doing 24 hours a day because the local neighbors were concerned about all these people hanging out around the stores at all hours and drugs and this and that and the other thing. So yeah, that was a safe space for a lot of people. And that safe space is not there. And people have to go somewhere. People who need to find someone at 4 a.m. need a space to go. And a lot of porn stores had the booths in the back or the back room where you could go hook up. And these were places that people would just kind of hang out and live like all the time. And I don't love the word safe space in general because I don't think that anything really can be a safe space. I'm not anti-safe space in terms of what people think it is. But when people say safe space, anybody could come into any safe space at any time and fuck it up, which I know from experience doing nightlife events and things on my own. But I think that those spaces were safer than other spaces for gay people to go and access. And that's, I think, what pornography was in general, was a safer space, a space where you could read and learn about yourself and learn who you are and learn about politics that you weren't hearing and hear radical points of view and see things that poked fun at society, the society that maybe your parents or your community were teaching you was the way to be. So that, to me, is the power of all alternative media and all media that dares to tell the truth.
Have you been able to fully wrap your head around what a sensation this has become? I mean, the preview was online and it just exploded all over every single blog, and there's been a ton of news stories and podcasts about this. I mean, you've been at this gay porn narrative game for a long time. Did you ever imagine it culminating in this? Or who knows, maybe this is just the beginning, but it's just been such a phenomenon. Have you been able to process it yet?
Yeah, I mean, it was really intense because it was like we're experiencing coronavirus and I'm spending every day in a moment where maybe I have 2 hours where I can actually think clearly and work during the day, and the rest are spent in a haze trying to quell my anxieties that, you know, my cough or something is corona, you know, and all of a sudden, like, everybody's just texting me like, oh my God, this is so great. This is making me happy. Oh my God, I'm crying. Oh my God, you know. So that was kind of intense and incredible. And I think it helped me get through that period in a way. And it sort of died down a little bit now, although I still follow all the Twitter responses and see all the responses around the world and think it's so wonderful, you know. But in terms of wrapping my head around it, I think it's only the beginning. And I'm really excited to be committed to making and telling more stories that hopefully people are going to be just as interested in, that shine a spotlight on these forgotten moments of gay history. There's so many important figures in history who are connected to porn, who people don't even know about. And I think part of my mission as a filmmaker and as a storyteller and as an activist is to bring a lot of that stuff to light.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You mentioned the future projects about the short films and the cruising areas in the World Trade Center, but you have another producing project coming up that's going to cause a stir for sure. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I'm producing a film for a pretty well-known director, Jeffrey Schwartz, who's done amazing documentaries about Divine, about Tab Hunter, about Vito Russo, and most famously about Jack Wrangler. He made the great documentary Wrangler, Anatomy of an Icon. So we're working on a film right now that is about the history of the movie Cruising and about the culture of cruising and about the real-life murders that inspired Cruising. And so we're in the process of making that movie and we're looking for investors. And COVID has made that hard, but we're not giving up and we're going to see that movie through.
Cruising is just a movie that will never die. It just has a life of its own. It really is quite something. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you. I'd love to talk with you again. I'm sure there's many more things we could
discuss. Oh, believe me, when the Cruising documentary comes out, we definitely will talk about
it. Cool. Great.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Congratulations on this ridiculously amazing project and its huge success. And I look forward to seeing what's coming up.
All right. Thanks so much, Brandon.
Thank you so much. I really want to thank Adam once again for being on the show. His dedication to prioritizing the role of pornography within the lives of gay men in his work makes him one of the most important producers of gay media working today. So I'm honored that he took the time to join me on the show. You really need to look into the show notes for this episode. There are links to Adam's music videos, his short film Jackpot, his articles with Butt Magazine and The Sword, and a link to the first installment of The Hunting Season. These are porn goodies that will keep you occupied for hours. While you're there exploring the show notes, be sure to click on the links to our social media. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/academicsex and on Twitter at pornocultures. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to getting sexy with you next time. Bye.